everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on an important issue, one that is generally not given a fair and objective presentation within the mainstream or even the alternative media. We collect together those individuals who have something significant to discuss. Today, the issue is Africa's growing military presence, or America's growing military presence in Africa, and the new colonialism of the continent. We have three panelists. We have Glenn Ford, who is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. In the 1970s, he was a correspondent and journalist covering Capitol Hill and the White House for the Mutual Black Network, and later hosted the nation's first syndicated black news interview program, America's Black Forum. Since then, Glenn has been one of the nation's leading voices in political and social analysis and commentary on current affairs in the black community. He is also a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association for Black Journalists, a board member of the National Alliance of Third World Journalists, and is a frequent lecturer on the role of progressive media at universities. Glenn's program, The Black Agenda Report, can be heard every Monday at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. His website is blackagendareport.com. Our next panelist is William Blum. William Blum is an author, historian, and critic of American foreign policy. He has worked and reported from three different continents. He was one of the founding editors of the Washington Free Press, the first alternative newspaper in Washington, D.C. His early journalism is best known for exposing CIA misdeeds and operations. His recent book, just released, is America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, published by Zed Books. His blog is killinghope.com, where you can read his frequent essays. Bill is currently the originator of the monthly newsletter, The Anti-Empire Report. And again, the book is America's Deadliest Export. And our final panelist today is Rick Rosoff from Chicago. Rick has been an active opponent of war, militarism, and intervention for over 40 years. He is the manager of Stop NATO and its internet activities, which focuses on the threat of international militarization, especially through globalization, of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Rick has written over 300 articles on international affairs, frequently published on the Center for Research in Globalization and VoltaireNet, and has been interviewed on radio and television programs across the world. His website is rickrozoff.wordpress.com. I welcome all of you to the program.
Hi.
For those of you who have not been on Progressive Commentary Hour, or those of you just tuning in, it's done a little differently in that I lay out an area for each guest who will have uninterrupted time to explore an answer. There may be a follow-up, but we have questions for each one, and we like to give them as much time as possible because we have to understand the context of their answers. First, let's take a look at the issue. The issue is that we have the U.S. African Command, AFRICOM. It is a puzzle. We are told by our White House, Defense Department, that we need this, that this will bring democracy and freedom and peace, and it will also help thwart terrorist activities in Africa. And that's how the American media, almost without exception, has accepted it, and hence become a major voice of promoting it. We're going to break this issue into three pieces. I'm going to ask Glenn Ford to address the first of these, and that is, first piece of the puzzle is to counter terrorism on African soil as part of the global war on terror. So what we know about AFRICOM is that it was started by Bush in 2007 when there was an internal restructuring of the U.S. command structure. And before that, military strategy for Africa was shared by three separate commands, Europe, Asia, and Central. To date, 14 African nations have publicly denounced AFRICOM. Only Liberia has offered AFRICOM a place to host its headquarters, but instead the U.S. had to make its AFRICOM headquarters in Germany. Now, much of Africa's opposition to AFRICOM is due to the role private military contractors such as DynCorp and Northrop Grumman has with the U.S. military. And one mission of AFRICOM is to train and equip African militaries. But we know the U.S. record in that arena, especially under the mantra of war on terrorism. AFRICOM propaganda is substantial. Videos and literature wish to paint a picture that the U.S. military is also involved with humanitarian assistance to the nations, like building schools and digging wells. And one reason why U.S. aid for Africa has been placed under the jurisdiction of the Department of Defense. And during this year alone, there have been growing operations. There have been other operations in other parts of the continent that were comparable in scale, if not in substance. Cutlass Express, U.S. naval exercise that focused on what is purported to be piracy in the Somalia Basin region, and African Endeavor in Cameroon, training in military communications. And there has been Southern Accord based in Botswana, and its objective was to establish a military working relationship between Southern African military forces in the U.S. and Western Accord, which was an exercise in Senegal that involved every type of military operation from live fire exercises to intelligence gathering to combat marksmanship. And there have been a number of other comparable exercises with names like African Lion, Flintlock, and Phoenix Express. In addition, U.S. National Guard units from around the United States have been rotating in and out of countries that include South Africa, Morocco, Ghana, Tunisia, Nigeria, and Liberia. So, Glenn, would you please give us your insight in what you believe the real motives for AFRICOM and the United States and military contractors to be there?
Yeah, and one of the first things I'd like to address is the misconception that AFRICOM has generated a great deal of resistance from African countries. In fact, it's been quite successful in suborning the governments and especially the militaries all across the continent. The fact that AFRICOM has not hung out its shingle, set up a formal headquarters in Africa, is rather deceptive. Actually, AFRICOM does have a base in Africa. Almost the whole small nation of Djibouti is a base for the United States and France. But AFRICOM's mission is not to establish these big U.S. Administered bases that can be magnets for popular discontent and anti-neocolonial political action. What AFRICOM's mission is, and it is has been extremely successful since 2007-2008, its mission is a kind of what the term I use is infiltration in force. AFRICOM has working agreements with virtually every military on the African continent, with very, very few exceptions, such as Zimbabwe, at present Sudan, and the small nation of Eritrea. But all the rest, at some level or the other, is acting cooperatively with AFRICOM. In fact, AFRICOM's influence with African militaries is such that the African Union's biggest mission in Africa, in its own continent, is in fact a United States-dominated mission. And I'm talking about the so-called peacekeepers or peace enforcers in Somalia. That's supposed to be an African Union mission, but it's entirely paid for by the United States and the European Union. And operationally, it's run by the United States, largely the CIA. The core of the soldiers historically in Amazon, the nominally AU African Union force there in Somalia, are Ugandans. The Ugandans and the Rwandans are the United States' closest allies, actually military henchmen in Africa, and so we see that this AFRICOM policy of officer to officer, that is setting up, creating very close relationships between general to general, major to major, captain to captain, and in the case of the Ethiopian military, on down sometimes to the company level, sergeant to sergeant, has created a situation in which African militaries are more dependent on, and I think it's fair to raise the question, they may have more deeper allegiances to the United States military and their U.S. officer interlocutors than their home governments. That is what AFRICOM wanted to accomplish. It's a kind of swallowing Africa whole, rather than setting up these big ostentatious bases that could only generate a political backlash in Africa. I believe that the officer classes of African nations have already been suborned to the extent that the United States can call for a coup d'etat in almost any country at almost any time it wants. That's the degree of success that this AFRICOM mission has enjoyed.
I appreciate that insight, Glenn. I would like a follow-up with you. For those who are younger and not versed in African history or American imperialist history, would you give us a background with some highlights of what we have done over the centuries in Africa, and especially since Cecil Rhodes, who was funded by the Rothschilds, who exploited the diamond mines and exploited the labor? Take us back through a history of Africa, our participation in that, so those who are in Africa today who have a sense of history and a lineage and take a look and say, why should we trust you now when everything you've ever done has been to exploit us? Take us on that journey now, Glenn.
Well, of course, the history of Europe in Africa begins before Columbus's voyage. The Portuguese were deep into Africa in the 1450s. In fact, I read that by the 1470s, one-third of southern Portugal's population were African slaves working in the vineyards of Portugal. So that history is a very long one, and it begins with European nations setting up forts at the mouths of rivers, and thereby gaining a dominant position in trade, introducing goods, new goods, and eventually trading them for human cargo. And the impact in the interior of Africa, where white men did not go for hundreds of years, was devastating, because it created an economy in the interior that was based on slavery, setting people not just at war with one another — people have always been at war — but at war with one another, with the goal of capturing their neighbors to sell them to the Europeans and join in the greatest manifestation of globalism to that time, and that was slavery. People nowadays are talking about this. There is a new scramble on for Africa, and they always refer back to the Berlin conference of the 1880s, and that's when the European powers got together to divide up the world, actually. Africa was the biggest undivided part, but it was actually a conference to cut the world up into spheres of influence, and that included parts of Europe as well. The United States was not yet a global partner power. It had not entered into its imperial stage yet, but it was there in Berlin as a kind of junior partner and getting ready to graduate. With the Second World War and the final exhaustion of European colonial powers in that war. The United States took a line of democratization, and this created the climate in which we see Geneva Accords and United Nations declarations on the rights of human beings, etc. This whole blossoming of international law. Well, what the United States was anticipating were ways in which it could create an international legal situation that would undermine the last vestiges of colonialism in ways that would finally prevent the Europeans from exercising monopolies of trade on their far-flung colonies and former colonies, and this would allow the United States, which was by then, especially by default after World War II, the world's greatest economic power, to penetrate all of these previously European dominated areas of the world without using European the means that the Europeans had previously used, that is, without gunboats. It is clear now, 60 years later, that the United States and its empire can no longer live within the rules that the Americans were so central to erecting after World War II. That is, the rights of nations, the rights of peoples, and the rights of individuals within nations. All of these laws, this whole edifice of international law, is now something that a declining capitalism with Wall Street at the head, a system that makes nothing and wants to monetize everything, can no longer live with. And so we see the United States now in a frenzy of waging war against international law itself, and the certainly the most active front in that war is in Africa.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you, Glenn. Please hold on. Now, William Bloom, your turn. Because your strength is so much in understanding U.S. foreign policy and its history and dealing with U.S. imperialism, I don't want to limit it to Africa, but I certainly would like to consider your position on this. And I want to read what the audience may not have read, but I did. It was Global Research's article by you. And it was entitled, American Foreign Policy, Have Our War Lovers Learned Anything? And here's what you say in your first paragraph. Over the past 40 years, of all the reasons people over a certain age have given for their becoming radicalized against U.S. foreign policy, the Vietnam War has easily been one of the most often cited. And I myself am the best example of this that you could find. I sometimes think that if the war lovers who run the United States had known of this in advance, they might have had serious second thoughts about starting that great historical folly and war crime. At other times, however, I have thought that our dear war lovers have had 40 years to take this lesson to heart, and during this time, what did they do? They did Salvador, Nicaragua, Angola, Grenada. They did Panama and Yugoslavia and Afghanistan and Iraq. And in 2012, American President Barack Obama saw fit to declare that the Vietnam War was, quote, one of the most extraordinary stories of bravery and integrity in the annals of military history, end quote. So have they learned nothing when it comes to following international law? Is the United States like the failed state, the Somalia of international law? Well, if they were perfectly frank, the war lovers would insist that the purpose of all these interventions and many others like them was to keep the atheist out of power. The non-believers in America's God-given right to rule the world, or to at least make life as difficult as possible for them. And thus the interventions were successful. I can go on, but you get the idea. My audience gets the idea. So take us now on your journey of the following. If we've learned nothing, and I believe we have learned nothing, We are now a country that has 18 million hungry children in the United States. We have 49 million people on food stamps. We have 12 million senior citizens who cannot pay their bills and are struggling and virtually abandoned. 1 million vets who are homeless or suffering from Gulf War Syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, and who have been abandoned by the VA and the military. We have cities in decline. We have destroyed our soil, our water, and we have learned nothing about maintaining our infrastructure. So then how is it that we have unlimited amounts of money to go into Africa or any other country and to spend whatever we need to private contractors to get what we need from there, and yet the American public and our politicians and the media have all been either quiet on it or supportive of it? I can't understand it. I'd like for you to explain it to us. The forum is yours.
Well, you say, you ask how is it, and I think you should ask, oh, why is it, to be more specific. There's never been any question that the U.S. government has enough money to build a very fine life for all its citizens, from senior citizens to young kids. They don't spend the money in those areas. They spend the money as part of a master plan to dominate the world. Now, this is very hard for the average American to accept. The idea that their government wants to dominate the world, that's something we associate with people like Hitler or Stalin or Mao Zedong or any other guy that we've been taught to hate. But this is nothing surprising. Empires have long wanted to dominate the world. That's almost by definition. And so that has to be kept in mind when you're looking at American foreign policy. One point I often make, which is almost my trademark, is that one will never understand U.S. foreign policy unless one puts aside the idea that we're all taught that the U.S. government means well in its foreign policy. We're taught that no matter how bad things may look on one occasion or the other, the intention is always honorable, if not noble. And that's why people on the left are so often faced with Americans who refuse to be swayed at all by the facts. I've gotten so many communications from readers telling me about people in their families or their friends who they repeat the pertinent facts to about U.S. foreign policy, and it seems to have no effect at all on the people they're speaking to. And I maintain that's because these people have, consciously or unconsciously, they hold very deeply the belief that their government means well in its dealings with other nations. And as long as an American holds to that belief, almost nothing you can say is going to sway him. You must deal with that basic belief about meaning well. And that's why I emphasize it so often. Because my writing is aimed at activists. I want to give them the tools to use to sway other people. That's my basic motivation. And so I emphasize that point a lot. Now, where were we?
let's get back to what what do you believe our real intent is to go into Africa, spending billions, tens of billions of dollars there, and what do you think the outcome is likely to be?
Well, it's, again, part of the master plan of world domination. Africa, as we all know, is part of the world. It would be very odd if the U.S. powers that be should pass over that entire large continent after they've dominated Europe and Latin America and Asia. Why would they pass by Africa? It's just part of the same planet, the same raison d'etre. So that shouldn't be a mystery. And we have kept African leaders down. You know, one of the arguments Americans use against Africa is, or the African people, is that they can't even find a decent leader. All their leaders are just so corrupt, and they are never impressed with the fact that whenever Africa has had a leader that was not corrupt and was willing to fight against the foreign imperialists, that leader has been overthrown by the same foreign imperialists. And for example, Patrice Lumumba of the Congo and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and the leaders of the former Portuguese colonies in Angola and Mozambique and other examples, the U.S. Has overthrown all these leaders over the years and left Africa in the sad state it's in. The political leadership is a mess there, and it's not by any chance. Even Mandela of South Africa, he has behaved in office. He was not any kind of progressive. He welcomed in the multinationals, and the ANC was very corrupt and still is very corrupt. So even his leadership was corrupted and cast aside. So there has been very few outstanding leaders in Africa in modern times.
Okay, please hold your thoughts. Let's say hello to Rick. Nice to have you with us, Rick.
Yeah, Gary, thanks for having me on the show. It's a real honor to be on with Glenn Ford and Bill Blum. It truly is. They're two of the people I admire most in the world.
Thank you. The U.S. went into Libya first under the auspices that we needed to get rid of Gaddafi, even though at that point Gaddafi had turned away from sponsoring terrorism and was trying to reestablish stronger ties with the United States. Now, of course, China was also present in Libya for oil. Now there's talk of the United States sending troops behind the French advance into Mali. And Mali was the site for the U.S. military exercise Atlas Accord 12 to provide training to Mali military. And Niger seems next with a planned drone base. And then in December, the Army Times News Service announced that the U.S. would be deploying troops into 35 different African nations. So what, in your estimation, is the major motive for this dramatic increase aside from the supposed threat of terrorism and al-Qaeda advances? And also, you've written about how the U.S. is creating its own kind of NATO strike force called the African Standby Force. Explain this and its ultimate goals and mission. And one additional follow-up question now. I'm opposed to NATO. This is a relic of the Cold War. And yet it's still being financed, still being controlled under American control. And why don't we ever have a discussion of why do we need NATO? Why do we need all of this militarism and all these bases, nearly 1,000 bases around the world, when we can't even fix bridges, tunnels, water mains, dikes, and levees in the United States?
No, I mean, those are all very good questions. I'll just, you know, quickly, so people know, the most recent National Defense Authorization Act will include $611 billion. That's a base budget and then special money apportioned for the war in Afghanistan and other military operations around the world. 2 years ago, that number was estimated between $711 and $728 billion, which is over $2,300 every one of the 300 million citizens of the United States. It's also an absolute dollar amount that is adjusted for inflation, constant dollars, the highest since 1945, which is World War II. So I think, you know, we have to recall that we're talking 20 years after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union, 25 years after the end of the Cold War and so forth, the Pentagon is spending money at World War II levels. And it's that sort of question that I agree with Bill on. I mean, you really want to grab people by the lapel and shake them up and compel them to look at figures like that. But on the question of Libya, if I can start with the beginning of your questions, Glenn was absolutely correct. You know, of the 54 members of the African Union currently, all but Egypt, which is still in the area of responsibility of the Pentagon Central Command, every one of those is is in the area of responsibility of U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. Meaning, AFRICOM has the largest amount of nations under its command of any overseas U.S. military command. It also, by the way, South Sudan will very shortly join that, to make it a 54th country in AFRICOM. But as of the beginning of 2011, there were only five countries. Glenn, mentioned the three remaining ones, Eritrea, Sudan, and Zimbabwe, that have not been in effect embroiled. And the Pentagon's nexus, not only for Africa, but ultimately the global military network. And the other two countries 2 years ago were Ivory Coast and Libya, and within months both the governments of both countries, those of President Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, were both overthrown with largely French military initiatives, and in the second case, of course, with NATO. We have to remember that from the beginning of the bombing of Libya in March of 2011, that is from March 19th through March 30th, that onslaught, which also included a comprehensive naval blockade of the coast of Libya, was conducted under a U.S. Africa Command auspices. It was known as Operation Odyssey Dawn. And after that, at the end of March of 2011, it was picked up by NATO under the moniker of Operation Unified Protection, where some 30,000 air missions were flown over a nation of barely 6 million people, almost 10,000 of them what NATO characterized as being combat sorties. So we get some idea that, major Western military powers had collectively spent over $1 trillion last year on arms on the military, and that collectively account for 70% of military spending in the world, ganged up on one small African nation, which by that point was, virtually defenseless. And we now see a replication of that, as you and the speakers have mentioned, in Mali. You asked me about the African Standby Force. This is a project of the Pentagon with the collusion of NATO. As a matter of fact, NATO spokespeople in the past have stated the African Standby Force is deliberately modeled after NATO's so-called response force, NATO response force, which itself was inaugurated in an African nation in the former Portuguese island colony of Cape Verde, Cabo Verde, in 2006. Which was a massive military undertaking, amphibious landings, warplanes, and troops, and so forth. So that I think it's pretty clear that the NATO response force itself saw its primary, or at least its initial mission, as being in Africa. And we have to keep in mind that NATO itself is a consortium of all the major European colonial powers, of Britain, of France, of Spain, of Portugal, of the Netherlands, later Italy, Germany, Turkey. And that what we're seeing is not only a new scramble for Africa, as Glenn alluded to, but we're seeing a more comprehensive recolonization of Africa. You asked why to both the other guests, and of course, raw materials and natural resources are key. But we have to recall also roughly 2 years ago, the collective population of Africa for the first time surpassed 1 billion people. That makes it the second most populous continent in the world. It's not only natural resources, it's human resources. It's human capital, if you will, in Africa that the West wants to dominate at the expense of other nations, most notably China, India, Russia.
Let's go to China for a moment, and then I'm going to ask each one of you to address this in whatever way you feel is best. I'm concerned. Let me first explain the larger issue I see. On the one hand, we have borrowed more than $1.7 trillion from China. We have been running multi-hundred-billion-dollar trade deficits every year for the past 12 years. We buy cheap products from China. China does not buy expensive products from the United States. We also have outsourced to China and India more jobs than we have created in the past 10 years. 58,000 factories have closed in the United States since 2000. Many of those in good times because it was cheaper to manufacture a product in another country that does not have good labor relationships, that exploits its local population, but makes major profit for those who are working the deal. China was the number one. India was number two. But China, which is either the number one or second largest country in the world population, it jockeys year to year between India and China. They're both about $1.3 billion. They have a problem. They're losing over 600 square miles of prime farmland per year, 1,600 in the last year. There is more desertification in China than any other country in the world. And they're using up their shallow wells. They're using up their deep wells. They're running out of natural resources. So they've gone to Africa and other countries in order to exploit what they can in those areas. But they've done it differently. The African-China relationships has noted for creating an economic and political structure so that they go in and help a country build up its infrastructure. They build the dams and the reservoirs. They do a lot. They have over 1 million people, now Chinese, living in Africa. And they are creating large agrarian places there. They're after water. They're after oil. They're after minerals. They control 90% of the world's important minerals, including many minerals necessary for computers. So when we look at China, we're looking at the one country in the world that will absolutely, positively pass the United States in the next 36 months to be the number one economy in the world. So when you look at the number one economy in the world, and you look at China targeting 300 million Chinese to go to Africa in the long term, their largest embassy for the Chinese in the world is in Ethiopia. And while the U.S. says they focus on humanitarian aid, the Chinese focus on business relationships and try to create win-win scenarios for both African nations and the Chinese in the long term. Chinese also the number one provider of small arms sales to Africa. China beats the West on a price and performance to the point where Western firms are starting to bid to Chinese subcontractors, and plans to build a coast-to-coast railroad and electricity and water network are underway. And of course, there's the terrible downside to China doing anything in Africa. Chinese immigrant farmers populating much of the best farmland, the Chinese creating phantom economy zones to avoid tax paid to the host nation, growing racism, such as in Zambia, where Chinese are treating local farmers similar to how the Israelis treat workers from Gaza, uncontrollable deforestation, overfishing, environmental devastation, and taking the best land in every country for themselves, paying cash for everything because they have more cash to spend than anyone else in the world. And so they're, in effect, they're taking over Africa. Now, how much sense does it make? And we're going to start with you on this, Rick. How much sense does it make to try to start a mindset for a new Cold War? As if we can't live without, the neocons can't live, the military-industrial complex cannot live, their supporters at Fox and other, you know, fascist networks cannot live unless we have this demon that we have to exorcise from ourselves by going in. So we have a perpetual war, and China is now in the crosshairs. What do you think the likely outcome is going to be when China finally says, enough, we're not going to go to war with you, there's too much to lose, but you're rather stupid. You're coming to us to borrow this money. You're coming to us because you need us. And now you want to intimidate us and threaten us. Well, sorry, we're not going down that road. You're going to need our minerals. You're going to need our commerce. I don't see anything good from what we're doing in posturing around the countries like South Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand and Australia and New Zealand as if we're going to put a military base there. What? That's going to scare the Chinese. This is so stupid. But this is what I'm saying, and now I believe that one of the reasons that we're in Africa is because we want to try wherever possible to deprive China of its resources. Those are my own feelings. They are subjective. I'd like your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, to get back to the African standby force, which is important, because what the West intends this to do, and, you know, incidentally, Africa originally was going to divide up the African continent into five zones, which correspond with the major regional economic zones in Africa, that is north, south, east, west, and central. And currently in Mali, you know, following as, you know, legionaries or colonial troops, quite literally, you know, the French warplanes and attack helicopters and troops and missiles that, you know, have been employed in Mali is a limited contingent of troops. And what is meant to be the West African Standby Force, that is that assigned to the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. And the overall plan, of course, for the West was to have African militaries, you know, beholden as they are, as Glenn has described, to the Pentagon in the first instance, you know, kind of do the West dirty work for them in Africa. You know, it's basically the East African Standby Force, or the East African Standby Brigade, that has intervened, or forces thereof, has intervened in Somalia with several thousand troops, most recently with Ugandan and Kenyan troops. And these are all U.S. military clients, of course, who are to police the African continent on behalf of the U.S. and its NATO allies. That's the game plan. So necessarily, you know, ipso facto, that's meant to diminish, if not exclude, Chinese influence on the continent. You're raising the question of a comparable development of you know, Asia Pacific NATO in the Asia Pacific region. That's well underway. And what we've seen, but I would say in this case a little bit different than you know, simply a parallel to NATO. What we're seeing right now is an international military, global NATO, as it was referred to in an article 7 years ago by the current U.S. ambassador to NATO, Ewald Alder. This you know, the advocates for North Atlantic Treaty Organization becoming a global military force. And we have to recall, with the war against Libya that you brought up 2 years ago, NATO has now waged war in three continents. In southeastern Europe, in South Asia, and in North Africa, and in none of those areas anywhere near the North Atlantic Ocean, of course. So that you know, China might be well advised to stand its ground in Africa, because if it if it's evicted from there, the Asia Pacific pivot, so called, you know, moving, as you were alluding to, Gary, into military bases in Singapore, Philippines, Australia, as well as those already you know, current in South Korea and Japan and elsewhere. Is going to box in China, much as Russia has been boxed in with NATO expansion over the last 20 years.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight, Rick. Glenn, back to you. The U.S. past history in Africa, as you mentioned, has been terrible. The CIA-backed coups in the Congo that brought Mobutu to power, and in 1980, the U.S. Trained Samuel Doe's army in Liberia that led to the deaths of over 250,000 Liberians, plus propping up virtually half of the major tyrants, despotic regimes, and dictators to serve U.S. interests, including Mubarak in Egypt. And much of our foreign policy has been tied with World Bank and International Monetary Fund loans and economic conditions of structural adjustment, which ends up meaning they end up privatizing national resources. Do you see us continuing this pattern or changing it? And why is it that the Nation magazine and the corporate Democrats have not addressed this, and especially with Obama doing more than George Bush has done at this colonization and the commodification of Africa?
You know, I'd like to take that on by building on something that Mr. Razov was saying, and also talking about China. You know, throughout most of human history, China has been not just the population center of the world, but the economic center of the world, except for those centuries following the great European breakout of 1492, in which Europe, through constant wars and plundering of the rest, and deliberate underdevelopment of the rest of the world, became the center. So it's, you know, China bouncing back now that it is free of most of those constraints is nothing surprising. But what we're also seeing is, of course, India, not just be as a population center, but as an economic dynamo rising. And Brazil's Economic Development Fund, I forget the actual formal name for it, but their Economic Development Agency actually has more capital than the World Bank. So what we see is the United States and its junior imperial partners, the Europeans, are in a kind of desperate attempt to hold back the productive forces of the world, to hold back the natural trade an interaction between the Brazils and the Indias and the Chinas and the Africas of the world, and to keep that kind of productive potential under lock and key by military means. And that is why, as Mr. Razov was discussing, that is why they focus in Africa not on developmental schemes that in general we associate with China, where China will build a railroad if that's what's necessary, build a port if that's what's necessary to get the resources from one place to another, and when they leave, the railroad and the port are still there and not necessarily with political strings attached. The United States instead looks towards keeping a situation in which it can rig markets and coerce favorable, advantageous price relationships through the use of coercive force. And that's why its focus in Africa is military. It is AFRICOM. It is to buy the loyalties of African militaries as a final fence to cordon politically the Chinese and Brazilians and the Indians and even the Malaysians as they actually do trade and development on the ground in Africa. The United States is saying, okay, you go ahead, you do your deals, but we've got the soldiers and that will not translate into a political arrangement.
Thank you for that. Mr. Blum, wouldn't you think that we would have learned something from our efforts at political overreach and colonization or private interests and globalization in South Africa or South America? Take us through what we did in South America, very similar in many respects to when we supported Pinochet and the other regimes in Colombia, in Argentina, in Brazil, and what we're doing in Africa, just so people who may not be familiar with our overreach and our meddling in their affairs and how we supported the military dictatorships that disappeared tens of thousands of people, and we've never apologized for that, and yet we have had proof from Freedom of Information Act documents released that Henry Kissinger and others were part of the overthrow of Allende and in Chile. Take us through what we did in colonizing or interfering in the democratic governments of South America and what we're doing in Africa as a comparison.
During the Cold War, it was said that the U.S. could initiate or stop a coup d'etat in Latin America with a frown. If they frowned upon it, the coup plotters would change their plans. And the result was a century of overthrowing governments and suppressing popular movements and revolutions. And the list is very, very long. In the southern portion of South America, the culmination of that in the 1970s was the establishment of four or five very brutal dictatorships at the same time in Brazil and Uruguay and Argentina and Paraguay and Bolivia. The poor people of the southern half of South America had a very difficult time, and it's only in the past decade that all this has come to an end, but we're still living with the legacies. We're still trying to punish some of the perpetrators, for example, in Chile or in Argentina. It was a nightmare for many years. Beginning in 64 in Brazil, and it was not too much better in the rest of Latin America. Whenever a halfway progressive government attempted to come to power, it knew that it had to deal with the the great beast up north, and more often than not, the beast won in Salvador and Nicaragua and Panama and
Colombia,
Guatemala and Colombia. I mean, most of the nations of Latin America at one time or another were either overthrown by a U.S.-supported or engineered coup, or if it was something homegrown, then if it was a right-wing dictatorship, they could count upon the support of Washington, and they knew that Washington would not make a move to overthrow them, as opposed to the cases where a homegrown progressive revolution took place. Then they knew they had to deal with a great attempt to overthrow them, like in Cuba, for example, in recent years in Venezuela. It's been an amazing record on Washington's behalf. They have never hesitated to overthrow any government that was not to their liking, and that's why that expression came to be. The U.S. could just, if they frowned, coup plotters would change their mind, or they would go ahead with their plans.
But there is, Mr. Blum, there is a blowback to that, and that is right now as we speak, 23 Central and South American countries have signed an agreement to exchange in their own currency, not using the dollar as a reserve. China, India, South Africa, and Russia, the BRIC nations, are also now exchanging their own currency. So it's not, is the dollar going to lose its position as the reserve currency? It's when. And when it does, watch how little value there is in the dollar at that point. These countries that have been manipulated over the decades have not forgotten our legacy. Now, my final question here is for you, Rick. Many of us believe that the real reason that we are in Africa is not primarily because of terrorists, but rather because of resources. Africa has an enormous amount of oil. It has minerals that we need, but we can't be honest about it. Also, Africa is the country where you can buy land cheaply, throw the native population off, all indigenous people go away, millions of them. Whether they starve to death is immaterial to the hedge fund people. And we can manipulate the price of land. We can manipulate the price of commodities grown on the land. That's the hedge funds and the people who are in commodity trading. That's what many of us feel is the real reason we're there. This whole military exercise is just a cover. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm not as conversant or well-versed in the other matters as you are, Gary, so I'll defer to you on that. It sounds persuasive. But on the question of whether the U.S. military is in the Sahel region of the Sub-Sahara to combat terrorism would be laughable if it weren't for the loss of human lives there. We have to recall the U.S. was supporting the likes of Abdel Rahim Belhaj of the Libyan fighting group and so forth less than 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And the very same people that the U.S. claims are fighting under what is actually called the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative, formerly the Pan-Sahel Initiative, to combat shadowy groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. In fact, we see the U.S. supporting the very same forces in Libya 2 years ago and Syria currently, and wherever it's necessary to support them at any point in the future. The U.S.-backed overthrow of the government of Ivory Coast 2 years ago also had nothing to do with terrorism. The U.S., the Obama administration 2 years ago announcing it was deploying special forces to four countries in Central Africa, to Congo, Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Uganda, has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. So, they use whatever pretext needed, but at the end of the day, the U.S. expands its military footprints throughout the continent.
Yeah, can I jump in here and say something?
Yes, please.
The world needs resources, not just the United States. Everybody in the world needs resources, and all of the resource exporting countries need to export them. That's not the question. The question is, what is the terms of trade? Africa's biggest, the single nation that trades, has the largest proportion of trade with Africa, is China. But we don't see China overthrowing any governments. Latin America's biggest trading partner is now China. But we don't see China trying to overthrow any governments in Latin America. So it's not a question of some dire need for resources that forces nations to do things that they'd rather not do. It's the system of imperialism that says, this is how I work. This is how I'm going to work it. And that has put the United States in a position of being opposed to the rule of law itself. When President Obama led from behind, as he liked to call it, the assault on Libya, he refused to recognize that it was a war. He told the Congress that was not a war because no American soldiers that we know of were killed. So he redefined war in Africa. He used this African scenario to redefine war as being something in which Americans are killed, but Americans can kill as many people as they like. Hundreds, thousands, millions, and if Americans don't suffer casualties, no state of war exists. This is a total perversion, not just of the rules of war, but of the way human beings look at the world, of common human decency. I remember when I was a very young reporter, like 20 years old. And it struck me that every place the United States wanted to intervene was designated as a strategic point on the earth, places I'd never heard of. And I couldn't understand that until I got an understanding of what the nature of empire is. And an empire needs to dominate everything. That is, you become a target of empire if the empire's dominance, total hegemony, is not recognized. That becomes the strategic point on the earth. So we have a little country of 100,000 people called Grenada, way out in the furthest outpost of the Caribbean, which was designated a strategic interest of the United States and then invaded. And now there are strategic places covered with sand all over North Africa that must be invaded and dominated by the United States. That's not the logic of trade or the logic or even a military logic. That's the logic of empire.
Thank you very much, Glenn Ford, William Blum, and Rick Rozoff. I appreciate you sharing your insights with us on our Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.